It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We travel through time to explore moments of climate change and lessons to apply today to prevent the worst outcomes in Wisconsin and across the globe. Thanks to Mike in New London for suggesting this conversation with climatologist Michael Mann. And Mike told us climate change is the elephant in the room.
When you think of the word existential, it means our continuing existence on this planet, this blue speck.
Colin with a question. Add your thoughts, 800-642-1234, the number to talk. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Mann, professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania, directs the Center for Science, Sustainability in the Media. New book, it's called Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to be with you, Kate.
So at the beginning of your book, you say you want to answer the question on everyone's mind, are we doomed? And you say the answer is entirely up to us. How hopeful, how pessimistic are you that we humans will meet this challenge?
Yeah, I call it the D word. We hear a lot of it these days. And it's understandable, right? Because we are witnessing these profound climate change impacts now. Extreme weather events, deadly storms, withering heat waves, wildfires. We've seen it all. And the fear is that somehow this, we've begun some sort of runaway process that's unstoppable and it will just get worse and worse. And so that isn't actually true. The science tells us that if we bring our carbon emissions down to zero, the planet stops warming up. And so I decided to write this book to sort of look at those lessons from the past, because sometimes you hear reference to one of these past natural extinction events, climate-driven extinction events like the Great Dying that happened 250 million years ago at the end of the Permian period. 90% of all species on the planet perished. 96% of all ocean life perished. And so you hear people refer back to that and say, hey, that's what's happening today. It was driven by runaway warming that was unstoppable then, and that's what's happening now. It's not what's happening now, and I felt like I had to sort of reclaim paleoclimate history for its rightful role in this conversation, because really that's where I started out in the field of paleoclimate two and a half decades ago when we published the now famous hockey stick curve.
The hockey so stick curve.
Yeah. Very popular in Wisconsin, you know, where hockey reigns supreme, but yes.
And, you know, some people might say like, oh, yeah, that's the hockey stick scientist guy. But can you remind us that the famous hockey stick curve, can you explain it and why it's still today it illuminates the massive impact we're having on our climate?
Yeah, you know, it is this graph that we constructed 2.5 decades ago. We tried to extend back the record of global temperature because the thermometer measurements that we have only go back about a century and a half. And while it shows this warming of nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit now, that doesn't tell us, the thermometer record alone doesn't tell us how unusual that sort of warming is. And so we turned to natural recorders of climate that we call proxy data, like tree rings and corals and ice cores, to extend the record back. And when we did that, what we found was that the warming spike of the past century that coincides with the Industrial Revolution has no precedent as far back as we were able to go. In fact, the curve looks like a hockey stick in the sense that it's relatively flat for the first, 8.5 centuries. And then that final century and a half, that's the blade, the upward turn in the temperature curve. And that blade gets sharper and sharper now as we continue to pollute the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and we continue to warm up the planet.
You note that it was climate change that happened millions of years ago that allowed humans to thrive on Earth. How did the climate make human civilization possible?
Yeah, you know, it's ironic because there were a number of climate events and accidents natural climate changes that are responsible for us being here in the first place. When the asteroid that struck the planet 66 million years ago, killing off all of the non-avian dinosaurs, we feel compelled to use that qualifier because birds are actually dinosaurs. And so we see dinosaurs every day, but all of the other dinosaurs and any megafauna, any animals larger than a dog basically died because they couldn't burrow into the ground to escape the extreme cold from all of the material, all sorts of particles and smoke and soot that were ejected into the atmosphere, cooled off the planet. So yeah, that was an accident that favored us, because when the dinosaurs were gone, the small mammals that had been hiding in the rocks could come out, and those mammals would eventually go on to become primates and hominids and ultimately us.
Michael Mann with us, director of the Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media at the University of Pennsylvania. New book out. It's called Our Fragile Moment. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Bring your question, share your comments as we discuss climate then and now. Let's go to Chris in Port Wing. Chris, hi.
Good morning, and thank you for having Professor Mann on. His book is another good tool for us to move forward on this issue, and thanks for taking up the issue. I wanted to point out that the fossil fuel industry's press releases and social media work is generally trying to promote disenchantment and feelings of hopelessness in people so that they won't work against the use of fossil fuels, and it's important not to become despondent. And also, as someone who's been in the solar industry for 35 years, I can tell you, technology is not going to be the only solution. We need to actually reduce consumption. And ideas like my partner in it, Wendell Berry's idea of a national rationing program for fossil fuels is the sort of thing that would make a difference. And I believe we need to nationalize the coal companies and the oil companies so that we can control their behavior. Thanks very much for the show.
Chris, thank you. Chris, pointing to the continued burning of fossil fuels, generating the carbon pollution that's pushing our planet harder and harder, and then the pushback from the industries. Michael, what do you see?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. That was a great question. And in a sense, it was sort of more the subject of my last book, The New Climate War, which is about the tactics that are being used by the fossil fuel industry to sort of lead us down the path of disengagement. They don't want us engaged. They want business as usual. They want to maintain the status quo. And so where the connection lies with this new book is that, as Chris alludes to, one of the tactics they've used, ironically, is doom mongering, despair mongering. And, you know, very good people become, you know, victims of that, right? A lot of people have been taken in by doomism and convinced it's too late to act. But there's some bad actors at the top who are sort of fanning the flames because they realize it can lead to disengagement. It doesn't matter whether you deny climate change is real or deny that we can do anything about it. In either case, it potentially leads you to the sidelines rather than on the front lines where we all need to be. And so part of the impetus for this book was to sort of drill down on some of what has been driving that doomism. And I have seen the paleoclimate record weaponized. So often the science is misrepresented by, you know, fossil fuel interests and those promoting their agenda, but I've seen the science misrepresented to further an agenda of sort of doomism and inevitability. And often by taking some of these past extinction events, like that, you know, that end Permian extinction, the great dying that I talked about, you hear people say, oh, that was driven by runaway methane-driven warming, and that's what's happening today. Well, that's not what's happening today, and that's not what happened back then. So part of the purpose of the book was to reclaim some of these past paleoclimate episodes for their rightful role in the conversation. But beyond that, really learn the messages that the paleoclimate record, the record of Earth history, has for us today. And there are 4 billion plus years of messages there. And I try to unpack that in just a couple hundred pages.
So if the greenhouse effect was happening billions of years ago. Why hasn't the planet kept warming over that time?
Yeah, one of the stories I just love talking about, because it's just so full of fascinating cultural references and important developments in our science, is the so-called faint young sun paradox. 4 billion years ago, the sun was about 30% as bright as it is today. And so if you do the standard calculations, we should have had a frozen planet. And yet it wasn't a frozen planet. We know there was liquid water. In fact, the oceans were teeming with microbes, with primitive bacteria. So how can that be when the sun was so dim, the planet was livable? And Carl Sagan, the great Carl Sagan, first sort of put forward this paradox, the faint young sun paradox, and offered a solution, which was the greenhouse effect must have been greater. There must have been higher concentrations of greenhouse gases. And what's fascinating, and this led to the subsequent Gaia hypothesis that I talk about at some length in the book, What's fascinating is as the sun got brighter, the greenhouse effect over billions of years gradually got weaker in just such a way that the temperature of the planet stayed within habitable bounds. And that's probably not a coincidence. And it speaks to the resilience of the system to a point. The system, our climate does have these restoring mechanisms. It is resilient to a point, but if you push it too hard, and we see some examples of that too in the major climate record, it can spin out of control. And that's the danger in what we're doing today.
University of Pennsylvania climate scientist Michael Mann, latest book, Our Fragile Moment. There's more conversation ahead. Share a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
Dinosaur, you really couldn't ask for more. You're God's favorite creature, but you didn't have a future. Walking in your footsteps.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Climate change is a crisis, but a solvable one, according to climate scientist Michael Mann at the University of Pennsylvania's Department of Earth and Environmental Science. New book out. It's called Our Fragile Moment. And thanks to Mike in New London for suggesting this conversation. And you can take part. Call in with a question. Share thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, you write about moments in Earth's history when the climate is pushed into extreme cold, and you call these moments snowball Earth. What has caused the Earth to become frozen?
Yeah, so, you know, there are these restorative mechanisms that I mentioned before that tend to keep the temperature of the planet within livable bounds. And life itself has contributed to those restoring mechanisms through the global carbon cycle, through the way that plants take up CO2, for example, and help bury carbon. So the irony is, in the long term, overall, life has played a restorative role in our planetary history, but there are times when life has behaved in just the opposite way, nearly acting in a way to nearly extinguish all life on Earth. And one of those episodes happened about 2.5 billion years ago. It's called the Great Oxidation or Oxygenation Event, I should say. And it arose because a new pathway of photosynthesis arose among bacteria that produced oxygen. And suddenly, for the first time in Earth history, our atmosphere filled up with oxygen. There was no oxygen in the early Earth atmosphere. We couldn't have survived in the early Earth atmosphere. It was very rich in methane gas, for example, a very potent greenhouse gas. Well, that increase in oxygen scavenged the methane. It oxidized the methane, took all that methane out of the atmosphere, that reduced the greenhouse effect dramatically. The planet cooled down. Ice started to form. Ice forms, then it starts to reflect sunlight back to space, creating even more cooling, creating even more ice. It is what we call a positive feedback, but it is, in fact, an amplifying feedback that did lead to a runaway effect, not a runaway warming of the planet, but a runaway cooling. And the Earth became encased in ice. We call it Snowball Earth. Life probably survived in refugia, deep hydrothermal vents in the ocean, or maybe some very shallow pools of meltwater right at the equator on top of the ocean. And so life almost extinguished life. And so the question we have to ask, which of those roles do we want to play? The restorative role that life has played overall, or the punitive role that it has played at times like that? And today, of course, we are impacting the climate, warming the planet at a rate that has no precedent as far back as we can go. And that really is reason for us to take pause and to recognize the fragility, the true fragility of this moment and the need for urgent climate action.
There's the global ocean conveyor belt that you write about, you know, moving water around the planet. Why is this conveyor belt so important to our climate system?
Yeah, you know, your viewers may have seen a caricature of what would happen if the ocean conveyor shut down in the form of the movie The Day After Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's now a couple decades old. It's a caricature, but there is a grain of truth to the movie. The warming of the planet, the melting of ice, that ice is flowing into the North Atlantic Ocean, freshening it. And fresh water is lighter than salty water. That inhibits the sinking motion in the polar regions of the North Atlantic that help drive the global conveyor belt. And we know that, for example, it collapsed at the end of the last ice age because of all that meltwater. And parts of the North Atlantic sort of went back into ice age-like conditions for hundreds, in fact, nearly 1,000 years. So the worry is today, with all the meltwater that we're producing, we could get a similar episode. It's very unlikely we would see another ice age like happens in the film. But what would happen, some areas of the North Atlantic could cool. And more importantly, it would interfere with the sort of the behavior of the ocean, the upwelling of nutrient-containing waters that supports the sort of very rich marine ecosystem in the North Atlantic and one of the great natural fisheries of the world. That could collapse if the conveyor belt were to collapse. And one other thing, for oceanographic reasons I'm not going to go into because it involves pretty complicated physics, but it would also lead to an extra foot of sea level rise along the U.S. East Coast. So it would be a disaster. The models predict it shouldn't happen for another century. Observations suggest it may already be happening. A reminder that uncertainty isn't our friend here, and there are surprises in store, but they're not going to be welcome ones, again, underscoring the case for urgent action.
And, you know, that's kind of where my stomach drops. You know, if we destroy the conveyor belt, if we, we can't fix the conveyor. I mean, if we can't refreeze ice sheets, it wouldn't be feasibly possible in the span of human lifetimes. When you point that out to me, because I always look like someone has got an innovation, someone can fix this, but those things are not exactly fixable, and we will see that sea level rise.
Yeah, you know, if the conveyor belt on your power saw breaks, you can call in a mechanic to fix it. You can't do that with the global ocean conveyor. Mm-hmm. It's what we call a tipping point. It is a point of no return. Once you set in motion that change, you can't reverse it. Even if you could somehow cool the planet back down, it will take thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years for some of these sort of systems to become restored after we pass these potential tipping points, and we don't know where they lie. So it's like we're walking out onto a minefield, and each of these tipping points is a mine that we could set off if we warm the planet beyond that threshold. We don't know where those thresholds are. That's why it's so critical to keep warming to an absolute minimum. We can prevent warming of more than 1.5 Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what we think is sort of the level of warming where we start to see some of those worst consequences. We can still do it if we bring our carbon emissions down dramatically. We've got to reduce them 50% this decade and bring them down to zero by mid-century. It's a tall task, but it's doable. The obstacles aren't physics. They're not technology. They're entirely political at this point.
Michael Mann, climate scientist with us, author of Our Fragile Moment, How Lessons from Earth's Past Can Help Us Survive the Climate Crisis. You can join in with your question, your insights and comments at 800-642-1234. Michael, I do like that point when you talk about how the dinosaurs lacked agency, that there was nothing the dinosaurs could have done about the asteroid and their plight. But that, you know, that we're different, that we diverge there. And can you talk a bit about the dinosaurs and how we are distinctly different than that situation?
Yeah, and you know, you played at the beginning of the segment a little bit of
that was for the, you. That was for you.
Yes, thank you so much. Walking in your footsteps, a song when I was growing up, I listened to The Police. The album Synchronicity was this smash album, and one of the tracks off that album was Walking in Your Footsteps, and it was about the lessons that we need to learn from the dinosaurs. They, of course, perished because of an asteroid collision with Earth that created very cold conditions because of all the material that was injected in the atmosphere. And the analogy that the sort of Sting and The Police were making was that back in the 1980s, with the threat of global thermonuclear war, the same sort of mass destruction could take place. We could be threatened in the same way. It turns out that the connection was even deeper than The Police realized. And I go into great detail in the book because they weren't aware of the phenomenon of nuclear winter. It's something that Carl Sagan had pointed out. The same Carl Sagan we talked about earlier had, you know, pointed out that one of the results of a global thermonuclear war would be a potential nuclear winter. Just like the chilling effect of the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, we could generate our own winter. The Police wouldn't have been aware of that when they wrote that song. It was more than a year before Sagan's publicity campaign. They were mostly thinking about the physical destruction and the radiation that would occur and how that would kill off large numbers of people. But the connection was much deeper than that. And that's why it's such a profound lesson. The dinosaurs had no agency. They couldn't have done anything about it. We don't have that excuse.
I think about your book when you keep saying over and over, there are always winners and losers. What is the most important lesson that we humans need to understand as you look at those categories of winners and losers?
Yeah, you know, we sometimes hear people say that, oh, the planet will be fine, you know. And when we say, you know, the planet is threatened, of course, what we really mean is a vibrant planet with, you know, with rich ecosystems and human civilization and thriving human civilization. That's what we mean, of course, not a lifeless husk of an orb floating in space. Yeah, technically that would still be Earth, but that's not the Earth that we want. That's not the Earth that we're trying to keep. And so, yes, there are winners and losers. And we see that with each of these episodes. One person's extinction event, you know, the perishing of the dinosaurs, was another, you know, species opportunity, the mammals and eventually the primates and us. And so there are winners and losers in that sense. But with human-caused climate change, there will be overwhelmingly more losers. All of us in the end will be losers because we're an interconnected society, a global civilization that is interconnected. We are reliant upon each other. We are reliant upon these thriving ecosystems. And so, there could be some winners. You know, cockroaches maybe will survive a mass extinction event, but that's not the sort of planet that we want to leave behind for our children and grandchildren.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Michael Mann, professor at University of Pennsylvania. The book is Our Fragile Moment. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.